again, I'm very happy to be here, and I want to thank all the organizers. And as an anthropologist, I will the center of my talk will be certain stories that I limit in a certain time. So I'm going to speak about the fall of 2007 till the winter of 2008, 6 or 7 months, within which a topic which is all the time discussed, over and over again, every time, the same way and in another way, has had several eruptions or several appearances or events. So I will try to just give you a little snapshot of those events and try to make a certain or a limited analysis of these events concerning the veil, which, of course, it's an endless topic, and I will not go into its detail, but limit myself to those events and even to this very limited 6 or 7 months. In the fall of 2007, I spent 4 months in New York, and at that time, a new book by the historian John Wallach Scott came out, titled The Politics of the Veil. Now, John Scott is a very well-known feminist historian, and she's an historian of France. She never wrote about Islam or Judaism as such, and never dealt with the veil. But somehow she was pushed to deal with the controversies that happened in France in some of them in 1989, 1994, and 2003. And I think she wrote for a conference a small paper on a certain side of the topic, and was, and in a way, developed into a book. When the book appeared, of course, it aroused a lot of noise in New York. She's very well known. And we must know that her treating of the veil came from a different motivation of what we are talking here. She used or tried to use the controversies of the veil to learn about the République, to learn about France, to see how she can understand deeper and different and in a deeper way and different ways questions of the République. So she didn't interview veiled women, she didn't speak with veiled women, she didn't take their side, she didn't try to understand their politics, although she touches upon it here and there, but tried to look at the French side of it, to understand why is it such a great manner. Without going into the details of the book, it's a good book, and I had some difficulties with this book, as always, with strong claims. It has one chapter that I will relate to. It deals with the laïcité, with individualism, with racism, and it deals with sexuality. And that's the part that I will take. And since she deals with the veil vis-à-vis the state, this is what I will try to do with the with the further events that I will bring, this time from the life of Jewish women. So she says, in the chapter that deals with sexuality, I quote her, she says, there was, in those events in France, she says, there was something sexually amiss about girls in headscarves. It was as if both too little and too much were being revealed. She tries to develop an argument saying that the women with the scarves presented a challenge to the French perception of gender, sexuality, and eroticism. An alternative that had to be pushed away by saying that she says there was something too much and too little. People saw too little of what they wanted to see in the presence of a woman in the public sphere. They saw too much, and they saw too little. And that she develops very nicely this argument that mainly wearing the scarf as a political act, in a sense, was in along many other action. Talking about sexuality was a challenge to the way the French, and when she says the French, she means the French white men, middle class Christian men, saw too much and saw too little. And not in the book, she also compares it to the question of the thong underpants. You know, when you see when the in France when women were showing the underwear, and what is it when you see too much and too little? When you see more than you want to see and not enough of what you want to see. And she, as I said, she deals with it in order to understand the attitude of the French Republic and to understand the meaning of the Republic. At that time, in January 2008, if we'll have time, we'll go back to other arguments that she has here. She quotes people saying about it in another way, the language of the body is that of its accessibility to the other sex. When French people were debating the veil, this is one of the things that were said, you know, that presenting your body in the public sphere is also a language that tells me about the accessibility of that body to the other sex. Okay. So there's something to think about. A month later, or after this book came out, of course, the events have no relation to each other, or maybe they do have relations to each other. Turkey had another session of dealing with the veil. I remind you, you all live in Europe. You all know that Turkey is in dialogue with the EU to be part of the EU, and this is one of the problems. Paradoxically, maybe the EU will make it possible for the women to wear veils in universities as part of their civil rights. But on the other hand, as far as women don't have full rights in Turkey, it will be a block to enter the EU. So it's a very complicated relationship between what Turkey has to present to the Europeans in order to be part of Europe. At the New York Times at that time, Sabrina Tavarnish writes, the Turkish government's decision, at that time, if you remember, there was this decision, to lift a ban on women wearing headscarves in universities raised a troubling question. Is Islam starting to erode Turkey's secular democracy? So again, there was this question, Erdogan is the prime minister, his wife is wearing the scarf, she could not go to the university because she was wearing a scarf, he's a very charismatic and a strong leader. So again, Turkey is going just to another phase, nothing new, nothing started then, it's just another phase, but a strong phase that the government lift the ban on the veil. So another country, another form of laïcité, another republic. There is an event in the winter of 2008. Of course, it didn't last. It didn't last. Women in Turkey still cannot go to the university veiled. Another snapshot, Morocco. When I was in New York, I was part of a group of the anthropological group at Columbia University, and a PhD student at that time, I assume she finished her PhD, Nadia Goussous, wrote about left-wing feminists in Morocco. And part of her dissertation, she talks about the aversion that the left-wing feminist, Moroccan feminists have of their sisters who are veiled. And she tries to understand this aversion. Why is it so hard for them to accept their own sisters, not biological sisters, but other women who are very, very opinionated, very strong. You can call them feminist, you cannot call them feminist, but why is it so hard for them to accept, to be in dialogue with other women who are wearing the scarf? Now, the work of Nadia Gassous is already taking into consideration the work of Scott, Talal Assad, and it's very sophisticated theoretically. But for me as an anthropologist, it was also very important because she has ethnography. She is interested in the women, not in the state, not in the republic, not in laïcité as such, as norms, but she's interested and she brings into the discussion the voices of the women themselves because she interviews and she makes observations of both the left-wing feminists and the women that they are dealing with. So that's another snapshot, another thing that was happening to me or took my attention when I came back to Tel Aviv. And Another just insert that I must say, when I was still in New York, I got an email from an Israeli journalist working for Haaretz, which is the best newspaper, and she asked me, have you heard about the group of women who are veiled, Jewish women veiled? And I said, no, I'm in New York. She said, there is this thing, I'm writing this article about a group of women in Bet Shemesh who are veiling themselves. You haven't heard about it? I said, no, I'm sorry, I haven't heard about it. And then I saw her article, and I will come back to it. This will stand at the center of my talk. But when I came back to Israel in February, if you can please put the first picture, there was an article in the local newspaper of Tel Aviv, written by this woman, her name is Adi Kantorovich. From her name, you may understand Adi wouldn't say much. Could have been a Palestinian, but Kantorovich, she's an Israeli girl, Jewish girl, who decided to do what many journalists did before that, like Black Like Me in the United States, or German journalist pretending to be Turkish. She put the hijab on and continued her life in Tel Aviv as usual. Went to work, went to the bars she's going to, continue to do whatever, went to her yoga classes, just wore a hijab. And she said, I didn't do it in order to know that Israel is racist and that I will get racist comments in Tel Aviv. I know that. That's not a big deal. But I had to put it on because I said I will never know what it really means until I put this thing on me and experience it as I go along. And she tells all kinds of things, but let me just note two things out of her long article. She says, there is nothing I know of, not any other garment, not any other piece of cloth that I know of, that one can put on which declares, I am an Arab. Politically, I mean, from identity point of view. I'm not going into the history of the veil we were talking about. We're talking about it as a performing act, as a political act. I am an Arab. Now, saying it in Israel, it makes sense, because it's a binational place, and we have Jews and Arabs, and that's an Arab thing. But we must take into consideration that it's not in this, wearing it in this way, we must make the distinction between Arabs and Muslims. There are Arabs who are Christians, there are Muslims who are not Arabs, and the fact that we say it so easily in Israel and in other places, Muslim and Arab, as identical, is something that as researchers we have to think about. Why are we doing it so easily? And be cautious about it. Another thing that she says, which took my attention specifically, she went to a gay bar in Tel Aviv, and she met two of her friends, a couple of gay Palestinian Israelis at the bar, and they told her, why do you insult our religion? This was really interesting. A lot of her Palestinian friends, and it's not that every Israeli has Palestinian friends, but she has Palestinian friends, didn't like it at all. Didn't like her game at all. And this is also something to think of. And this couple, this gay couple, told her, this one thing to do what we do in a bar, and another thing to play games with religion. We keep our filthy things in the bar and we have to be clean somewhere else. So these were two other things that I carry with me as I continue to the main events I want to talk about. Now, her trying to create a noise is sort of a playful thing that she can allow herself, she can afford herself. She's an Israeli, she's Jewish, she's well-educated, she lives in Tel Aviv. You can see from the picture that she goes in Shderot Rothschild, which is now renovated, it's like the main boulevard. in Tel Aviv, people sit out in cafes, having dogs. If you can read a picture, the context is very non-Arab. You know, it's not in an Arab village, and it's not even at the university where we do have students wearing hijab. So she's like, she is aggravating and playing the game, and she can take it. She's not going to pay anything for it. She's not going to be penalized for it or mocked. And all the racist remarks she's going to take will come up nicely in her article. Okay, so for her to walk like this the street of Israel, being covered as a Jew, is one thing. But we are going to talk about other Jewish girls who walk covered in the streets and have to go through a totally different scenario. Okay. So, as I mentioned, Tamar Rotem, that journalist, and also Sari Makover, who writes in Ma'ariv, told a story in November about women who cover themselves in a very funny, new, unknown way. If you can move to the second picture. Okay, and maybe to the third, and then we'll go back. The pictures are not, okay, that's the general look. It's as if like a group of cloth walking, you know, lots of cloth, lots of material walking where you actually cannot see nothing. It's not what we know of hijab, like we saw, you know, when you really see the face, and many times with makeup, and the face are very strong. Not even this way, which is way more covered, but we still see the face. Not anything that we were familiar with. And both journalists tell about the women, a group of women, not too many of them, something like 50, in Bet Shemesh, which is a little town in between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, one of several towns that were developed lately due to lack of apartments, enough apartments in the ultra-Orthodox neighborhoods in Jerusalem, in Bnei Brak and Tel Aviv, places where young couples can afford to buy apartments and go out. But these new settlements, new Bet Shemesh, Kiryat Gat, Shoam, Elad, those places where ultra-Orthodox people now live, and they didn't used to live, have become sort of no man's land. You know, the rabbis are far away, they're young couples, they're away from their parents, and it became to be like the West in the United States, where they send those who are not so, and all kinds of funny things can happen there, which cannot happen in Jerusalem, or less so, or in Bnei Brak. Both journalists talked about one woman. That's the woman, Lucia, if you can go back, the woman that we saw. Yeah, her name is, they said her name, Bruya Keren. She grew up in a traditional family. She became more Orthodox, or what we call Baalat Shuva. And she's a melange of everything that we have today in Baalot Shuva. She's an alternative healer. She's a vegetarian. She's a spiritual. She has tried all kinds of alternative Torahs, all kinds of alternative philosophies. She tried to speak when she lived in Bnei Brak against the rabbis. Why are you allowing wigs? You are playing around. Why do you allow all the lycra material? It's too tight. And the rabbis didn't like her at all. She was known to the authorities dealing with social care, with problems with her kids. And she was sort of pushed away from Bnei Brak to Bet Shemesh. But this is not being told in the story of Tamar Rotem. Tamar Rotem comes to her house in the evening, and she sees a group of women talking to each other, and they tell her about themselves and how they take modesty seriously. And that comes, I think, in relation to what you were talking before about the law, the strict law of modesty, and how men and Judaism as a religion of interpretation play with a strict law, okay? So you are not allowed to show your hair, but you can put a wig. These women don't like those tricks, okay? You're not allowed to show your hair, don't show your hair. You're not allowed to show the figure, you have to be modest, let's be modest. Let's take it literally, okay? The men hated it. Their husband hated it. Some men applied for divorce if their women joined her sect. On one hand, the men want a modest wife, but, you know. And if they decide how modest she can, but what happened here is that the women started to decide, what does it mean to be modest? Because I have to, in parentheses, I will say here that, and that I wrote about it a lot, modesty has become like a monster. The women, wherever they go, all they hear is the rabbi talking about modesty, 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 modesty. So they say, modesty? Voila, modesty. I will show you modesty. Okay, it's not being said this way, but if I analyze the act, this is what I see. They take upon themselves not to speak several hours a day. Because you say that for the women, they say modesty is bat melech pnima, and women talk too much. Okay, you won't see me and you won't hear me. And the children will not be able to come to me. The children will not, mommy is not available. You don't see mama and you don't hear her. And this is, I will later talk about when the state came in, but the women were not available for caretaking several hours a day. They are not speaking. Okay? They put a cloth in between the passages of the house, like a tent, so it will be like the tent of Abraham and the biblical times, that kind of modesty, like the Bedouin modesty, okay? So they created, they remodeled the houses as a tent. And they had all kinds of these inventions. Most of them were Baalot Tshuva, most of them were not Ashkenazi, but if we will have time, I will talk about a more legitimate and accepted group in Jerusalem of Ashkenaziot who are called the Women of the Shawl. And they also have now their own initiative of what modesty really means. The next time we got to know Bruya Keren, please, if you can move, I don't know how much time I have, another one, please, is when she was arrested. I have 10 minutes, thank you. When she was arrested. This time, again, Tamara Rotem wrote a paper, wrote something about her in the newspaper, this time without her name. Because when someone is arrested, there is a possibility not to, the judge can decide whether yes or no to say the name of the accused, because he's just a suspected. But it was when she put in that this woman is a leader of a group in Beit Shemesh, and if you did one and one, you realize this is Bruya Keren. Okay, why was she arrested? For abusing her children. The paper said that one child was found outside the door at late night, cold night. He was knocking on the door, but mommy didn't open the door. The mother said that he was supposed to be at 7 o'clock at home. He wasn't home. I'm not opening the door. Another time, they said that she doesn't send one of her daughter to school. Another child was a little bit retarded and not taken care of. And the most sensational accusation was that they had arayot, that they had incest between, that's something that happened several years ago, that one of the boys reported to the authorities that he had sex with his sister. The mother was taken into arrest, and she's still under procedures. It's been over a year. And she will be accused of several things. I don't know for the incest, but for neglecting, for abusing her children. That, of course, the first article that Tamar Rotem wrote about this group was not, didn't take that much of attention. Again, something exotic, again, those crazy ultra-Orthodox, a little story, no one remembered. But when this came out, and the accusation of abuse in an ultra-Orthodox family that has so much pretense of offering a new way of living, a new way of family, correct family, having so many children, this is something that the non-Orthodox especially like. Because when this, the veil is revealed and you say, aha, your great families, you can never raise up 9, 10, 11 children and have them normal. You know, this is what the state, in a sense, wants to see. This is what the non-Orthodox people many times want to see. And it gained a lot of attention because at that time, within 1 month, 3 cases of abuse of ultra-Orthodox women came to the news. If you can go to the other picture. Okay. There were 2 cases, and most people, when I talk about it, most people put all the 3 stories together. They say, the woman from Mechemesh, she raped her son. The 3 cases are, for those who are not researching it, are coming together into one case. So I will just say, because I want to go to the analysis of the state. This woman was accused for rape. She was divorced, and in order to get at her husband, she had sex with her son. That was the accusation. Another woman, a Ashkenazi American woman, joined a sect of a crazy guy, and they were beating their kids really heavily to police them, and her baby lost his conscience and is still now a vegetable, is without conscience. So both of them were arrested, and both of them came very covered. So the presence, the performance in the news of covered women on one hand, and one of them, the other one, was always praying psalms in the court. So you saw the figure of an ultra-Orthodox woman totally covered. You don't see the face. In juxtaposed to the case of abusing children and being violent, really hit the news in this winter of 2007-2008. It was very, very prominent. This is when the state goes in. This is when the state lifts the veil. And what I want to say here, I will just put the argument, and if we have time, we can back to it. The Israeli state is very tolerant about veils. Now, what does it mean, tolerate? The idea not to allow people with veil to come to universities or to have a job or to do anything, never even raised. For 2 reasons. And that's also the case in France. Sometimes it has a connection for the ultra-Orthodox Jews. What does it mean you cannot come with a veil? Can you come with a kippah? What do you do with tzitzit? Shall we be with the Muslims, against the Muslims? It is clear to some of the rabbis in France. It is not clear to others. In Israel, of course, there are a lot of Orthodox women and men who present their religiosity on their body. So now, another law to differentiate the Jews and the Palestinians and the Jews. We have many of them, but the question is, do we want to have another one? It's going to be problematic. But the other thing is, it's very convenient that people are marked on their bodies as different. So when we talk about the laïcité, the idea maybe was, let's create a public sphere where everyone is equal or can appear as if equal, even though we know that people are not equal. But in the public sphere, we at least create an illusion or a possibility that here we can be citizens of the Republic. I hold on the criticism. I know we can criticize that. But at least as an idea, it exists, okay? It's not such a bad idea. It's an interesting idea. That at least somewhere we can be equal. But in Israel, in the public sphere, it might be very convenient if I give a lecture at the university and I have a room full of students. It might be very convenient that I know who is Jewish and who is Arabic. If I see a girl sitting in my class with hijab, and I have many of them, immediately I know she's an Arab. And if not, I may assume that she's not Muslim. Many times she is, and she's not religion, less and less. And if I can see who is an Orthodox Jew and who is an Orthodox Jewish girl, so the state is very calm about it. And I offer it as a way of thinking that many times the tolerance toward hijab that me as a feminist and me as an anthropologist and us as part, I'm saying us as anthropologists, were many times backing the right to wear a hijab as a political thing, as an identical thing, we sometimes forget that banning the hijab is not only racist, is not only colonial. It is also a potential situation for equality, at least a potential situation. Because in Israel, for example, I know that my students who wear the hijab choose to do that, many times against their mothers, against their sisters, and even boyfriends and husbands if they're married. I know it's their choice, but they came to this choice from a very specific political situation in France, in Turkey, in Morocco, and in Israel. So the fact that Israel doesn't even offer thinking about creating a space where everyone comes in equal, it has to be analyzed not through concepts of tolerance, but through other sorts of concepts. So in a sense, when maybe in France someone says, pick up your veil so I can see how you are doing, you know, how and you can look like any other person. In Israel, many times you hear the state saying, cover yourself so I won't take you for another one, so I won't be mistaken of you, so I know who you are. Now, the women of Beit Shemesh, and that will be my concluding sentences, the women of Beit Shemesh made it all a mess. And they were called the women from Kabul. Their neighbors, their ultra-Orthodox neighbor, put stickers on their houses, go away, Muslim women, go away, the women of Kabul. And they started to say, when I have to go, they don't want, and also they don't cover like a hijab. You put the hijab when you go out of the house, okay? These women were politicizing the house. They were hiding in their own houses. They didn't cover themselves when they went out. They tried not to go out at all. They didn't want to go into the university with a hijab. They didn't want to go anywhere. But if they had to go somewhere, they used to take one of their children in their hands, wearing kippah, also to show them the way because they cannot see the way, like blind, but also so that people will see that they're Jewish because the kid is with kippah. Because in Israel, you go through a lot of checks of surveillance. You go into the bus station, they check your bag. You go into a store, they check your bag. If you're an Arab, they really take it apart. If you look like Jewish, he looks at you, you look at him, and he says, go. Now this bag of cloth comes in. Of course, they start taking, and she doesn't want to take anything apart. She says, they open all my bags. They throw my shopping on the ground. They do all this, so I don't even want to show them my identity card because in my identity card you see my face. So I take my child with me and so they can see that I'm Jewish. So in this respect, they made it a mess because by covering themselves and by doing all that, they crossed the borders of being Jewish, being Arabic. On one hand, they really praise the modesty of the old, of the biblical time and the Arabs. And on the other hand, when you tell them, you're an Arab, they feel insulted. So their act of politicizing their bodies had to do something in the house, but of course when it came to the national border, they didn't want to cross the national border. The state from its side needs the marking of the body to make it clear who's who, but doesn't want it to go too far. And the last sentence is that the only time that the state penetrated the home and lifted the veil of the face of the women was when the children, when the mother could be blamed of the role, the women could be blamed of the role as mothers. Not as women, not as sexual figures, but as mothers. This is the only time when the state intervened and interfered and made a step into the life only when something in the family, in the caretaking of the children, seemed as wrong. This is the only time that the state cared about these women. Okay, thank you.